Good afternoon. I have made a list of extra problems which are basically culled from old exams or something similar. They are basically problems of a type which I would think are would be appropriate for a final. Right. Are there questions? Yeah? No, the stabilizer is a subgroup. It's the subgroup of all elements which fix this particular point. So if your group is, say, symmetries of some geometric object in space, you could say, you have it act, say, on faces, and then the stabilizer would be those rotations where this face stays in the same, I mean, the face itself doesn't necessarily stay fixed, but the face stays in the same position. No, the cosets of the stabilizer now correspond to the orbit. And that's the important correspondence there. Okay. Other questions? No? On Wednesday, we were basically looking at, an example of a factor group. So our group there was the symmetric group S4. I could write down generators 1, 2, 3, 4, and 1, 2, for example. And this is a non-trivial equality that these two elements actually generate the symmetric group S4. It's something I happen to know, but in general, one really would have to check that this holds. If it is given in a problem, you obviously can use it and assume this that this is true. Just as a warning, because it happened in some homework, the homework I didn't bring. It's graded, but it's lying in my office. So you can just come by, or I'll bring it on Thursday for the exam. So symmetric group is four. These are two generators. The group does not just consist of these two elements. These are the generators, right? The group consists of all products of these generators and their inverses and iterated products. So we take this group, and I take a normal subgroup N, which is generated by 1, 3, 2, 4, say, and 1, 2, 3, 4. And then we have two further elements in there, which were not listed as generators, namely the identity and 1, 4, 2, 3. And I might have written down different generators last time. Okay. Now we can check that N is normal in G. How do we check this? I check that if for every generator here and every generator here, that G inverse NG is an N for all generators G in G of G and N of N. In general, the definition said I have to test it for all elements, but we had seen it is sufficient if I just test it for generators. Okay, so one can check this, and one can check that this is a normal subgroup. Then, what is G modulo N? It's a set of cosets. Well, this group has order 24, this subgroup has order 4, so we have 6 cosets, and these 6 cosets I had written down as the coset with representative identity, the coset with representative 1, 2, the coset with representative 1, 2, 3, with representative 1, 3, 2, with representative 1, 3, and to the coset with representative 2, 3, and I'm pretty sure I had them in a different order last time, which doesn't matter for a set of elements. And the fact that the representatives here form a subgroup is a very special situation. This holds here. It does not hold in general for cosets. The reason it holds is basically that this is a normal subgroup which intersects trivially with S3. And together they generate as false. So that's why I can choose the coset representatives in as elements of S3. But this is really happenstance here. Okay. That the coset representatives are the elements of S3. That makes working with these cosets easy, but this is really luck for this particular example. Okay. And I certainly could have chosen other coset representatives. For example, other representatives are possible. For example, if I look at the coset with representative 1, 2, 3, 4. Which coset is this? Yeah. So, how could I find a representative there? I would have to find one of those elements that I can divide it off from here and get an element which lies in this normal subgroup. Okay. So I want, what would that element have to do? If I divide off 1, 3, then I would have 1 goes to 2. I think, okay, this is a slight guess, but I think this is the same. Why is this the case? And you might want to copy it just once that I've verified that it really holds. If I take 1, 2, 3, 4 times 1, 3 inverse, what is this? This is 1 goes to 2, stays fixed, 2 goes to 3, gets mapped back to 1, 3 gets mapped to 4, stays fixed, 4 gets mapped to 1, gets mapped to 3, and this is an element of the normal subgroup, right? So, this coset, they are the same. They just are different representatives for the same coset. And I could have written, instead of writing the representative 1, 3 here, I could have written that representative here, and then all the issue of, oh, they happen to be elements of a subgroup would have been gone anyhow. Okay. How do I do arithmetic of cosets? Let's suppose I take n times 1, 2, 3, 4, this coset, and I want to multiply it with a coset, say with representative 1, 2, 3. How can I do this? I just need to multiply the representatives. So multiplying this product, 1 goes to 2 goes to 3. 3 goes to 4 stays fixed. 4 goes to 1, goes to 2. 2 goes to 3, goes to 1. Okay, so that would be the product here. I just take the product of the representatives. If I wanted to know which coset is it, which of these cosets is it, I would have, again, to try to find out basically find a suitable representative. Well, in this case, I can observe that instead of this representative, I could have chosen 1, 3. And so if I multiply 1, 3 with 1, 2, 3, I have 1 stays fixed. So I think this should be the same as n times 2, 3. Okay. And here, again, this is something one needs to check. If I multiply this coset with itself, what do I get? Well, I multiply the representative with itself, so I get 1, 3, 2, 4, and I observe that 1, 3, 2, 4 is an element of my normal subgroup n. So this is the same as n times the identity. So this is a coset as an element of the factor group. It's an element of order 2, right? because if I multiply it with itself and I have two factors in total, I get the identity. And the element is not itself the identity of the factor group. So this is an element of order 2. Or if I would look at n times this here, it turns out this is an element of order 3. Okay, what you see from this, and that's why I picked this particular example, that the order of elements in the factor group is not necessarily the same as the order of the representative, right? Here the representative has order 4, but in the factor group the corresponding element has order 2. And that can happen. In general, the only thing we can say is that the order in the factor group divides the order in the group. Why is this the case? So note, the order of a coset NG divides the order of G. Why is this the case? Because if I take the coset NG and I take it to the power order of G, that's the same as N times G to the order of G, and that is N times the identity, which is N. So that's the identity element of the factor group. And we had seen in, I think, at least in some homeworks, that if an element to some power is the identity, the order must be a divisor of that exponent. So, if we have a factor group, we can only talk about the order of the elements, dividing, being that the order in the factor group of a coset with a representative divides the order of the representative, but it, as this example shows, the order is not necessarily the same. Okay, now we have the definition of a factor group. I can finish the last part of this one problem, which unfortunately had gotten in a little bit too early. Namely, I looked at the, if we look at this particular subgroup, G is an arbitrary group, and N is the normal subgroup generated by these elements X inverse, Y inverse, XY, where X and Y are arbitrary elements in G. So I take the subgroup generated by all of these elements. We had seen already it is a normal subgroup. Okay, now, why is G modulo N abelian? Then if I take arbitrary elements of G modulo N, so let's say I take Nx and Ny as elements in G modulo N, which are arbitrary elements, I claim the factor group is commutative. So let's see what happens with Nx if I take Nx times Ny, and I take vice versa, Ny times Nx. Okay. So if I take Ny times Nx, that is clearly by definition the same as Nyx. I do arithmetic just on the coset representatives. And here, of course, I get this is N times XY. Okay. Right. And now I want to show these two cosets are the same. How can I show that they are the same? I can show they are the same by showing that the quotient of the representatives lies in N. So what happens if I look at XY times YX inverse. What is this? This is XY, X inverse, Y inverse. Right? And XY, X inverse, Y inverse, I claim, lies in N. This is an element in N. Why is this the case? Well, it has the form just for X, I basically replace X by X inverse and Y by Y inverse, and then it's actually one of these generators, right? and X and Y are arbitrary elements of the group. So this is clearly an N, the quotient is an N. So these two cosets are the same. So therefore, multiplication in the factor group is commutative. So for this particular factor group, is commutative. Vice versa, if you just assume you have an arbitrary, you could look at the same calculation as a necessary condition. For a factor group of some normal subgroup to be abelian, you need this condition. You need that all elements of this form are in the normal subgroup. So this particular normal subgroup is the smallest normal subgroup such that the factor group is abelian. If you have two factor, if you have any normal subgroup with abelian factor group, it must contain all elements of this form because they basically come from the equality test for products in both ways around. And therefore, this is the smallest normal subgroup with the abelian factor group. Okay, that just finishes a question from last time, which I had delayed. Okay. Yeah, we can. Oh, sorry. Well, the factor group is a set of cosets, right? All cosets together form the factor group, and that's exactly the same as with the factor rings. There, we have a ring, an ideal in there, and the cosets of the ideal form the factor ring. And now we're doing exactly the same, just we replace ring by group, and ideal by normal subgroup. We have a group, we have a normal subgroup, we take the cosets of the normal subgroup, and they form the factor group. And we have seen, indeed, it is a group. And we can do all kinds of things. This is, again, a group. We can do things like calculating the order of elements. We can do arithmetic there. And we get... slightly more messy to write down. It's not as convenient necessarily to work with, but as a group, it's as good as any other group. And again, the reason for constructing factor groups is, on the one hand, to construct, actually as a method for constructing particular examples. Another way, and this is, again, where a large amount of finite group theory has gone to, is to say, if we have a finite group, assuming it has a normal subgroup, I can take the normal subgroup and the factor group. They are again groups, and they are in some way the building two parts from which the group is built. And now I can try to iterate this. Well, when if I have a proper normal subgroup, the normal subgroup and the factor group are smaller, so clearly this can't go on infinitely often. At some point, I end up with parts which I can't split off anymore. For example, if I have a group which has prime order, because then every non-identity element must have prime order as well, and therefore the group is cyclic, and we know that it can't have any proper subgroup. Well, it can't have proper subgroup because a prime does not have any proper divisors. And so you can ask, a very obvious question is, what happens in the end? What are the atoms? And these atoms are called simple groups. These are groups which do not have any normal subgroups, and they have been classified in an enormous endeavor which ended, well, it was announced in the early 1980s, but the last parts of the proof actually were just published around 2004. This is that all finite simple groups were classified, and they are in some way the atoms of finite groups. Every finite group can be, in a certain way, composed from these using via normal subgroups and factor groups. But that's again far beyond what we could do here in the course. Okay. One last thing which I want to mention, and we had some of it already a bit on the homework. It's not something which I'm going to do in the exam, but I thought I should at least mention it. That's group homomorphisms. We had ring homomorphisms. These were maps from one ring to another, which preserve the ring operations. We can similarly find maps from one group to another, which preserve group operations. And that's what will be called group homomorphism. And if you have a group homomorphism, which is onto and one-to-one, it is called a group isomorphism. And then both groups in some way are the same. And in the same way as with rings, that we had a natural homomorphism from a ring to a factor ring, we always have a natural homomorphism from a group to a factor group. With rings, we could redefine the kernel of the homomorphism. These were all elements which were mapped to the additive identity element, which was zero. Similarly, for a group homomorphism, we can look at the set of all elements which are mapped to the identity element in the image group, which is this set again is called the kernel. And analog to the situation with rings, the kernel of a group homomorphism is an ideal. Not an ideal, it's a normal subgroup. Kernel of a ring homomorphism is an ideal. Kernel of a group homomorphism is a normal subgroup. And every normal subgroup can be obtained as kernel of a suitable group homomorphism, for example, the corresponding natural homomorphism. So there, the situation is exactly analog. And if you don't write words, if you just write symbols, this triangle for a normal subgroup or ideal, you can almost copy the theorems verbatim from rings to groups, just replacing ring by group and ideal by normal subgroup. And that's in part why I felt it admissible that we didn't really go much or didn't really go at all into this topic for group homomorphisms, because the situation there really is exactly analog. Okay. I think that's the point where I probably should stop with new material and ask there was the question with an office hour. So I think I should be able to have an office hour next week, Tuesday at 11. We are grading calculus, so it is possible that I will temporarily not be in my office, but then be back within 5 minutes or so, just in case something comes up which needs attention. So if I'm not there, just wait possibly 5 minutes or possibly even shorter, and I will be back. And I should be there till, certainly 11 to 12. Right. Yeah. So, are there any questions? Yeah? That a group is cyclic. Okay, you need to find an element which generates it. Right? You need to show that every element of the group can be obtained from some single element. Okay. So let's suppose we have a group which is cyclic and we have a factor group. Okay. So we have G is cyclic. So I know that G is generated by a single element. Let's call this element A. And now I want to show, I have N is a normal subgroup in G, and I want to show that N is cyclic. Okay. So to show that it is cyclic, basically I need to find one element, which is a generator, and I need to show every element of the factor group can be written as a power of this generator. Okay. So, first question, if G is cyclic, what are actually the elements of G? Of what form are the elements of G? They are all powers of A, right? So G consists just of A to the K, where K lies in the integers. Okay, so what are the elements? Oh, no, not N is cyclic, sorry. G modulo N is cyclic, that's what I want. N is also cyclic, but I want to show that G modulo N is cyclic. Right. Have the form A to the K for some integer exponent K, right? That's the definition of being a cyclic group. So what is G modulo N? What are the elements of G modulo N? They are cosets, right? So G modulo, the elements of G modulo N are cosets N times little g, where g lies in the group G. But I know what little g is, what the elements of G, what form they have. So the elements of G modulo N have the form N times A to the K, where K lies in the integers. Right? Okay. So far I've just written down what are the elements of a group, and then I've written down a description, what are the elements of the factor group. So now the question which I'm asked is basically, can I find one element in the factor group that all other elements could be obtained as a power? Any idea what element I might want to take? Well, A is not in the factor group. No, not the identity. Certainly not the identity. Well, I mean, you're almost there. It's just you want the corresponding factor group element, right? That's N times A. That's not A. Right? They are different things. So, A is in some, well, it's almost, if you want, this is almost desperation. That's basically the only particular coset which we can pick there. A is the only thing we have. Right? So I would have to pick N times A to some power. What power should I pick? Well, if I pick 0, I have N times the identity, and that as powers just gives me the identity. So that clearly is not going to work. So let's try the next obvious case, N times A. So now the claim is G modulo N is generated by the coset N times A. Okay. Why is this the case? Well, I just need to show that every element of this form can be obtained as a power of this element. Right? How can I get this? How can I get N times A to the K? How can I get this as a power of N times A? Well, by the way, how we do multiplication with cosets, if I just take the kth power here, I get the same. Right? So, this coset, is the kth power, this coset is the kth power of this coset. Well, so this calculation shows that every element of the factor group, every coset of N, is obtained as a power of the particular coset N times A. So this is the proof. So this shows the factor group is generated by this element. And since it's just a single one, the factor group is cyclic. Other questions? Yeah?
For number 4 on this, you want to find the stabilizer and representative of those sets.
Yes.
Based on the tetrahedron.
Yes.
It's fairly difficult to draw a tetrahedron in multiple cases. So what do you want to
do? Okay, what I would want you to do is probably first. The first task there would be, yes, unfortunately, probably it would be to draw a tetrahedron. It doesn't have to be in perfect perspective or so. It's good enough if one can just see what you have there. And what I probably then would do is just to describe you need to describe elements, and for describing them, you might want to describe them by drawing for each element a short comic which says how does it rotate the thing. But it's much easier to put labels on your tetrahedron and to say, you describe what your tetrahedron elements do, say, with the corners. So every tetrahedron rotation now actually becomes just a permutation on 4 points. Okay. And now you want a stabilizer of a face. So you can pick basically whatever face you want. And then I would expect that you either give me generators or all the elements. Actually, since they're the stabilizer of a phase in this case has just 3 elements, it's basically the same. Or if you give me an argument which says, if I stabilize a phase, the only thing I can do is to do rotations which keep the face in the same place. This corresponds to rotation of a triangle, and therefore I have three. Okay, for coset representatives, and there will be four of them in total, because cosets correspond to the images of, right, cosets of the stabilizer correspond to the orbit of the stabilized element. The face has clearly an orbit of length 4, so we will have 4 cosets, and the easiest way probably is just to say, okay, so you can pick elements, you just pick 4 elements, which map your one face to all 4 possibilities. One of them is the identity. The others, I would give them by permutations from the drawing. And, I mean, and really, if you just have some crappy drawing, something like this, 1, 2, 3, 4, that's perfectly fine.
Yeah.
I mean, you can, even if you don't want to draw it perspectively, if you draw it as, if you just draw the edge diagram and you say 1, 2, 3, 4 and 4 is connected this way, even that's good enough. No. No. So probably I should, yes, I will make sure that if something like this occurs, that I will draw a picture so it's clear which thing it is. No, I would not expect you to have to draw a dodecahedron. Cube, yes, I think I expect you to be able to draw a cube. Other questions? Yeah? No, one, you have two sides of a sheet. That's why I said this at the first exam, that somehow if you start with one where you write a lot, you're in some way cut short in the final. No, I want, you can have one sheet, it can be double-sided. And, sorry? Letter size. Letter size and handwritten in your own handwriting. Don't start with photocopier tricks, or I don't want someone starting a business with who has a small handwriting, writing the sheets for all of you. And what I basically, the one reason for this is that I basically want you to make this, the creation of this sheet, some kind of review. What is the important element of the course? I mean, this will block you from copying solutions to all homework problems wholesale. So if I have a problem which is similar to a homework problem, I don't need to worry that some of you might have copied the solution to this homework problem or to that previous midterm problem or so. But also for you to go through and to say, yes, what is the important material? What do I need to write down? And yes, it is rather limited space. But if you think to it, I think you will be able to actually put the fundamentals of this course easily I would think you would even be able to put it on one side, but if you want, you can have two sides. Other questions? Yeah? Yes, there will be, I think there are, I don't remember the number, I think there's, let's say 7, but I might be off by 1, 7 problems in the final, and of these 7 problems, let's say probably 2, and I say probably because I don't remember them all by heart, 2 would be first midterm, 2 would be second midterm, 3 would be new. Roughly. And with some problems, you can argue, for example, it might be possible that you could do a problem in several ways. You can show it in a slick way or in a not so slick way, and then you could argue the not so slick way was as an earlier exam, the slick way is something newer. Other questions? Yeah? Yes. Okay, if we take the integers modulo m, all the integers modulo m, then the units are the ones which are relatively prime. Okay, the thing in problem 7, and that's the bit which makes it somewhat non-standard. Yes, I'm doing arithmetic modulo m, but I'm actually choosing not all elements, and I'm also choosing elements which all are not coprime. And my identity, therefore, is not 1. The identity before asks to show that the identity is 16. So a unit in this case, the only thing you can use is the definition of a unit initially, that there must be another element, so you can multiply them together and you get the identity, which in this case is 16. It turns out this ring actually is isomorphic to a ring of integers modulo some number. It's just in some way hidden behind some further arithmetic to have make you go back to the definitions. And you couldn't immediately go and just say, oh, a theorem says these are the elements. Other questions?
Number 2, I don't know the...
Oh, this roof symbol says intersection. So A intersection B, it's those elements, G and G, so that G is in A and G is in B. And how do you show that the intersection is again a normal subgroup? First, you show that it is a subgroup. Well, what you do is basically, and that goes through the whole time, you take a product of two elements. Both factors are in A, so the product is in A because it's a subgroup. Both factors are in B, so the product is in B because it's a subgroup. So the product is in A and B, and therefore is an A intersection B. And for normality, you would take an element in the intersection. Let's call this element X. You take an element G of the group. You take G inverse XG. And you need to show that G inverse XG is in the intersection. Well, because X is an A and A is normal, G inverse XG is an A. Because B is normal and X is in B, G inverse XG is also in B. So therefore, it is in the intersection. Yes?
A normal subgroup.
Yes? 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 Be in the group, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Anything else? I'm happy to answer questions. Yeah?
Can you just go over that again?
This one here. Why these two? Okay. Why these two cosets are the same? Okay. Okay. The 1-3 in some way. Okay. The 1-3, if you want, the 1-3 I can only justify after I did the calculation. What I did is I did basically this calculation quickly in my head. Okay, so, well, how would I find it otherwise? If I can't do the calculation quickly, I would have to try out the elements. And what can I tell? I can use this fact that the order of the factor group element divides the order of the original element. So, a coset, say this coset here, must have order 1 or 3, right? On the other hand, this coset must have order 1, 2, or 4. So unless this would be the identity coset with order 1, which would mean that is the case only if this is in the normal subgroup, I couldn't take this as a candidate. And it's easy to see because I know the normal subgroup that this is not in the normal subgroup. So clearly, this is not this coset. And so I can't pick the identity, so I just have 3 candidates to try out. And then basically you try the 3 out. Okay, so that's how I got the 1-3 here. Okay, so now how do I check that they are the same? 2 cosets are the same if the quotient of the representatives lies in the normal subgroup. Or lies in general, lies in the subgroup. In the case of rings, we have the same idea. We just have to be careful that we there have to take the addition as operation. So there, two cosets are the same if the difference of the representatives. So we basically logarithmize this. When we get the difference of the representatives lies in the ideal. Okay. And now I'm just checking this. I take the quotient of this by this, and I've just calculated the quotient because this element has order 2. It is its own quotient, so that's why I didn't even bother writing down the inverse. Okay?
So the quotient is the same as inverse with the negative 1 there?
Yes, the inverse, this means quotient A divided by B is just multiply A with the inverse of B, yes. And this notation is just, if you write things down, this notation keeps things in a line. Once you start writing things as a quotient, you need more space. The other thing, why I prefer to write it this way for groups, and certainly not with a fraction line, is that a fraction line hides from which way I divide. A times B inverse and B inverse times A are possibly two different elements in a group, if the group is not abelian. And if you write A over B, you don't need to know anymore where the B came from which side. And that is a very easy source for mistakes. I mean, in general, for the exam, look through once more the problems in the midterms, look through the problems in the homework. Clearly, some homework problems were just in the amount of work much more than what I can ask in an exam, simply because you have limited time. But look through the problems and just look at them, whether to see, do you have an idea? And if you want also these problems, just look through them. Do you have an idea? How would you attack this such a problem? If I'm asking for something, show that something is a subgroup. How do I show this? If I want to show that factoring has a certain property, do this kind of calculation in a factoring. How of a polynomial ring. How do I do this, the kinds of calculation? I think the exam is clearly the same way as the midterms and the homework were stronger on concrete. Well, it depends what you mean by concrete calculation, but I would say I consider show that this set is a subgroup still as a concrete calculation, while a proof would be show that the image of an ideal under homomorphism is an ideal or something like this. I think it is stronger on concrete calculations than on general proofs, and that's what we did in the course. Yeah, okay, yeah, I think you were first. Yeah. The final is on Thursday, I think at 11:20. In this room here, yes. I think it's 11:20 because they start at 7 and then they always have 2 hours and 10 minutes for each exam, with the 10 minutes being a switching time. So the next one is from 9:10 to 11:10, or with 10 minutes switching time, and then 11:20 we start. And since it's over lunch, if you want to bring yourself something to eat or to drink, as long as it wouldn't bother other people, that's fine with me. So probably, I mean, yeah, don't bring the extra crunchy crisps or the garlic chicken or something like this, but otherwise, obviously, you're welcome to bring something. And obviously, you're welcome to use the calculator, but again, if you can do things like I think the worst calculation we had in some way was something like 5 times 12 to calculate the order of the symmetry group of the dodecahedron or so. So if you think you can calculate 5 times 12 in your head, you probably won't need a calculator, but you're still welcome to use one. Anything else? Yeah?
We don't have the split set up. I wasn't sure exactly what it was like.
a cutoff for certain grade levels?
I very deliberately was vague on this sheet. And the reason is basically, I want to look, well, there are two things. One thing is there is a certain level of performance which I want to see. And on the other hand, I don't want to be deliberately harsh or to say, oh, this is the hard, very hard course. In particular, I know a lot of you aren't even mathematics majors. And the problem is just if I promise initially to be too lenient, I lock myself in. I lock myself potentially even into a situation that I have to say, oh, everything went fine. Now I have to put rather hard problems on an exam just to get a result which somehow is representative. What I want to do is to see in the end, okay, what is the performance overall? I haven't promised anything like a concretely like a curve, but I will probably do something like this and then see. What is the outcome of the final? How is the performance overall in the course? And I mean, if it seems that you've understood the basics of abstract algebra and you've worked through continuously through the semester, I hope to be able to give you a passing grade. It's really hard. And I'm happy after the exam, I can basically justify that's where the cutoff is and that's why I give the grades. But to give it, to say before, oh, this number of points, I mean, it also doesn't really tell you much with this. Don't aim with the exam that you say, oh, I now need only out of 100 points, I only need to have 63 points and now I work that I have something where I think I have 63 points. Do the exam. I think it will be clearly doable in the 2 hours we have. I certainly don't want to encourage anything which is, oh, here, I have good enough. Now I can stop working. Yeah. Yes, there certainly will be something. Anything else? We still have 3 minutes. If you want to ask questions, I'm... Yeah?
Some of your symbology with the arrow, the triangle that you have written on the paper.
Yes. The open. Okay. Yes.
They
both represent a This and this both represent subgroup. And I don't make, if I want to say a proper subgroup, I would say explicitly as a second thing, and I consider it to be not the same. If I have the triangle, it means, or a subring, if I have the closed one, it means normal subgroup or ideal. And again, I don't make any statement about equality or not, and in part it happens in particular on this sheet because this is called together from various places that I'm probably not always consistent. It depends how it's typed up. Basically, this is a symbol which is not on a standard keyboard, so I need to do something else there. That's why they differ. Anything else? Yeah? Well, I mean, ask. Okay. Okay. You know, every question answered. I mean, I'm glad if I have, but. All right, then, again, I will make sure that I'll be in my office Tuesday 11, and then otherwise I'll see you next week Thursday.